We would like to send out a special thanks to Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. You can download it free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Thank you, and enjoy the show. May 20th, 1982. Kendall, Florida. A fire breaks out at the home of 30-year-old Azat Abul Holson, and a badly burned body is discovered inside his garage, underneath a car. The body is tentatively identified as Azat, and after it is determined that a leaky fuel line caused the fire, his death is ruled to be accidental. However, after Azat's sister collects on a substantial life insurance policy, investigators become suspicious and eventually discover that the victim's teeth do not match Azat's dental records. Evidence suggests that Azat faked his death and fled to his home country of Lebanon, but he is never found, and the man killed in the fire is never identified. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we shall cover what might be one of the most bizarre stories ever featured on the podcast, the 1982 death of Azat Abul Holson. Or should I say, the possibly fake death of Azat Abul Holson, and the actual death of someone else. If you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you might remember the odd story of Clarence Roberts, which I also covered on the podcast just under 3 years ago. Clarence was supposedly killed in a fire until his body was found at the scene of another fire 10 years later, this time alongside his wife, Geneva. The most likely explanation for what happened was that Clarence faked his own death and stayed in hiding for the next decade before he was finally killed for real. Well, today's story has a number of similarities, but in this particular case, the so-called victim might have successfully gotten away with it. It involves a Lebanese national named Azat Abul Holson, who lived in Florida before he was supposedly burned to death in an accidental fire which broke out in his garage. Azat had taken out numerous life insurance policies on himself, but after his sister collected some of the money, investigators soon discovered compelling evidence that the man killed in the fire was not actually Azat, who had presumably faked his death and returned to Lebanon to live off the insurance money. But if that's what happened, then what actually became of Azat, and who was the man killed in the fire? This case was originally suggested to me nearly 2 years ago by a Lebanese listener named Amon, and once I started delving into this, I fell into a very deep rabbit hole. There are a number of old newspaper articles about this story, but a special shout-out needs to be given to a Reddit user named Wes Kendall Jenner, who did a lot of research on this case, and wrote an extensive post about it at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit several years ago, which was a very useful resource for putting together this episode. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start exploring the bizarre story of Azat Abul Holson. Our story begins in Florida in 1982. Our central figure is 30-year-old Azat Abul Holsen, who originally hails from Lebanon. Azat was born in Tuknai, a small mountain village located over 40 kilometers away from the capital city of Beirut. Tuknai has around 2,500 residents, who all adhere to the Druze religious faith, and believe it or not, every single one of them has the same surname, Abul Holsen, the namesake of the family who established the village. Azat was the only son in his family, and he grew up in a modest home alongside six sisters. After serving in the Lebanese army, Azat decided to travel to the United States as an exchange student in 1976 and studied civil engineering at Jefferson Community and Technical College. He would get married to an 18-year-old woman named Becky Basham, but shortly after receiving his green card and becoming a permanent resident in the country, Azat divorced her. He subsequently moved to Florida and rented an apartment in the Kendall suburb of Miami, which he would share with one of his sisters, Gada Abul Holsen. After living together for 18 months, Gada would move to Tampa to study nursing, while Azat started working as a real estate salesman for a land development company. By the time the spring of 1982 rolled around, Azat decided to move out of his apartment and rented a luxury house located on the same street. On the evening of May 20th, Azat visited his next-door neighbors, a married couple named James and Jean Kell. A few days earlier, Azat had purchased a used 1972 Chevrolet Vega, but told James that it had a faulty fuel line and asked if he could borrow a pair of pliers to fix it. After James lent him the pliers, Azat returned home to start working on the vehicle inside his garage. He would soon be joined by his best friend, Bassam Wakil, who hailed from a wealthy Syrian family and originally befriended Azat in Louisville before he relocated to Miami. Bassam helped Azat with the repairs on the car, but shortly after 8:30, told him he was going to grab some pizza and drove away. About a half hour later, the Kells heard what they would describe as a whooshing noise coming from Azat's house and looked outside to see that smoke was emerging from behind his closed garage door. While Jean called the fire department, James and a passing jogger ran over to the garage and started banging on the door, but the heat had become so intense that they could not get inside, and the fire was now starting to spread to the rest of the house. The fire department arrived and started dousing the flames, but while this was going on, Bassam Wakil returned to the house in his vehicle. He started running towards the garage while yelling Azat's name and had to be restrained. Once the fire was under control, the firemen finally entered the garage and discovered the burnt-out shell of Azat's Chevrolet Vega. A body was pinned beneath the vehicle and was burned so badly that it was unrecognizable. However, since Bassam confirmed that Azat had been working underneath the car when he left, it seemed certain that the body was him. After performing an autopsy on the victim, the medical examiner found no signs of trauma or traces of drugs or alcohol in his system, but his carbon monoxide levels were at 61.9%, nearly 30 times the normal level, so the official cause of death was determined to be smoke inhalation. Based on the evidence, investigators came up with a theory for what happened. While Azat was working underneath the Vega, the jack holding it up fell over, which caused the car to crush him. The jack also wound up puncturing the vehicle's faulty fuel line, causing gasoline to start leaking out. In fact, this may have been the source of the whooshing noise the Kells heard before they noticed the smoke. In a freak occurrence, the gasoline squirted a portable light Azat had been using to work underneath the car, and this caused a fire to ignite. The high levels of carbon monoxide in his system indicated that Azat was still alive when he was being burned by the flames, and his death seemed to be a horrific, tragic accident. All that being said, while the body was tentatively identified as being Azat, there was no way to positively confirm it was him, as the victim's fingerprints had been burned off, Azat's dental records were not available, and of course, we were still years away from DNA testing. But the body's size seemed to match, and there was no real reason to believe it wasn't Azat, so his sister Gada, who was still living in Tampa at the time, was informed about what happened. Gada was left devastated by the news and returned to Lebanon to mourn her brother's death, and also said that she would make arrangements to transport his body there for burial. Well, an unexpected complication would occur on June the 6th, when Israel decided to invade Lebanon for an armed conflict, which they dubbed Operation Peace for Galilee. As a result, the country's airport shut down, holding up the transport of Azat's body. It remained in a Miami funeral chapel for over a month before Gada contacted Bassam and gave him permission to have her brother cremated. Bassam went through with the cremation and kept Azat's ashes. Gada decided that she wished to remain in Lebanon and return to her home in the village of Tuknai, where she got a new job working at a local clinic. However, Gada would receive word that her brother had made her the beneficiary of a life insurance policy worth $500,000. She claimed to have been completely unaware that Azat had done this, but still traveled to Miami to collect the money before heading back home. The problem was that Azat had taken out five other policies with multiple insurance companies during the 2 years prior to his death, and together, they totaled up to $1.3 million. Even though Gada had collected the first payout, the other companies became suspicious and were reluctant to disperse the rest of the money, so one of them hired a private investigator named John Healy, who shared this information with the Miami Police Department. If that wasn't enough, it also turned out that while he was living in Louisville in 1979, Azat had been investigated by the police for insurance fraud due to allegations that he had paid someone to steal $2,300 worth of items from his house so he could collect the insurance money. But no charges were ever filed, and Azat soon moved to Florida. Well, even though Azat had been cremated, the medical examiner had taken his jawbones and held on to them before turning over the body. While Azat's dental records were still unavailable, a forensic odontologist believed that if he compared the jawbones to a photograph of Azat, he might be able to determine if the teeth matched. But finding a decent photograph was surprisingly difficult. Following Azat's death, his passport, driver's license, and green card could not be found among his personal effects. When these effects were turned over to his sister, Gada claimed that Azat's photo identification was in Lebanon. Bassam Wakil also claimed to have no photos of Azat, though he did remember Azat owning a photo album containing around 200 pictures which could not be found following his death. The only pictures investigators did have of Azat were not very useful since they did not show his teeth, but the lead detective eventually managed to obtain an old photograph of Azat from the Department of Motor Vehicles in which he was smiling. Well, since Azat had undergone extensive dental work in the past, the photo revealed some very straight, well-maintained teeth. By contrast, the teeth on the body were very decayed and had several cavities. Most importantly, they had two chipped front teeth and two teeth on the lower jawbone which overlapped, so after making a comparison to Azat's photo, the forensic odontologist was able to determine that the teeth did not match. John Healy would also travel to Azat's previous hometown of Louisville in hopes of gathering additional evidence and spoke with his ex-wife, Becky Basham, who told him that Azat had once gotten some wisdom teeth pulled at a local dental school in order to save money. Sure enough, Healy was able to track down this dental school, and they still had Azat's dental chart on file. When the records were delivered to the odontologist, he concluded that there was zero doubt that they did not match the teeth on the burned body and that the victim was not Azat. As a result, the case was reopened and reclassified as a homicide investigation. Gada and Bassam were questioned about the situation, but they both acted shocked and denied having any knowledge of what happened. They claimed to not know Azat's current whereabouts or the identity of the man killed in the garage fire. At the time, Bassam still had the victim's ashes in his possession, but despite finding out they did not belong to Azat, he decided to scatter them into the ocean. With little else to go on, investigators started questioning members of Miami's Lebanese community to see if they had any information and began hearing rumors that Azat had been seen in his home village of Tuknai and that he seemed to have recently acquired a lot of money. In spite of its remote location, a decent number of residents from Tuknai immigrated to the United States, and would often take trips back there, and since the Lebanese community were tight-knit, rumors spread very easily. Well, by the time 1983 rolled around, Dan Goodgame, a journalist who worked as the Middle East correspondent for the Miami Herald, decided to take a trip to Lebanon to see if he could track Azat down. With the help of a guide, Goodgame traveled through the mountains to Tuknai, which was not easily accessible at the time due to heavy snow. While Azat did not seem to be there, Goodgame was led to what was supposedly his current residence, a large three-story villa which was under construction. It was worth approximately $250,000, and two import cars and a pickup truck were parked outside. Goodgame did manage to track down Gada, who was now living with her mother. She confirmed that Azat was still alive and had left the area only hours before Goodgame arrived, possibly because he had been tipped off. Gada claimed that suspicions about her association with her brother's scheme had pretty much made her an outcast in the village, but she continued to deny any involvement. Even though Azat reportedly returned to Tuknai in May or June of 1982, Gada maintained that she never saw him or had any idea he was alive until December. This was after Gada had collected the $500,000 in insurance money, and she was left so disgusted by the situation that she turned over all the money to her brother and refused to keep any of it. Gada said she believed that Azat had taken a taxi to Damascus, Syria to fly out of the country and was planning to spend the next few years in Europe. However, Goodgame spoke to a number of residents of the village, including one of Azat's other sisters, who expressed their belief that Azat was still in the area and hiding somewhere. One villager claimed that many people were outraged about what Azat did, and that if they found him, they would take him to the nearest American embassy and turn him over to the authorities. But before Goodgame could pursue this lead any further, his guide advised him to leave Tuknai for fear that their lives would be in danger if Azat found out what they were doing. In the end, Goodgame wound up returning to the U.S. without ever tracking Azat down. Officials from the U.S. consulate in Beirut would state that even if Azat was captured and delivered to them, they were unlikely to return him to the U.S. because the country did not have an extradition treaty with Lebanon, so the decision on how to handle him would rest entirely with the local authorities. It's unclear what ultimately happened to Azat, or if he's even still alive today, but another big mystery is the identity of the burned body found inside his garage. To this day, the victim has never been identified, and no one knows how he wound up in that position to begin with. So after nearly three decades, the bizarre saga of Azat Abul Holsen continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. I've said many times that because this podcast covers unsolved cold cases, making an episode is often like putting together a massive jigsaw puzzle. I mean, even though my biggest passion is true crime, I do require an occasional break from this. So if I need a mental palate cleanser, but I still want to work on putting together puzzles, Best Fiends is a refreshing change of pace. While Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, it's a casual game anyone can play. It's made for adults, but it can also appeal to children because most of the characters are cute bugs, but the antagonists are not so cute slugs. You can collect tons of characters and use them strategically for each level. Overall, you can spend as much or as little time as you'd like on the game. In addition to the challenging and fun puzzles, Best Fiends also has a nice visual design containing very bright and vibrant colors which will always keep you engaged. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. It also updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. And that's very handy since I've been immersed in Best Fiends for months now. I'm always keeping you up to date on my progress, and I'm happy to say that I've recently passed the milestone of level 150. If any of you listening are Best Fiends fans, feel free to share your own progress in the game with me via social media. So engage your brain with puzzles and collect tons of cute characters too. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. So download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Well, this is a story you'd expect to find in a movie or a murder mystery novel, and it's surprising that it's not more well known. It did garner a lot of coverage in the media in early 1983, once it was discovered that the burned body was not Azat Abul Holsen, and of course the Miami Herald was right on top of the story, and went so far as to send one of their journalists, Dan Goodgame, to Lebanon to find Azat. But once Goodgame returned, the story pretty much just faded from the spotlight, and when searching through newspapers.com, the only media coverage I could find in the ensuing years were a couple of articles about elaborate insurance scams which would briefly mention this story. It might have completely faded into obscurity forever if it had not been featured on a 2012 episode of the Investigation Discovery series, Dr. G, Medical Examiner, which was hosted by Florida medical examiner Dr. Jan Garavaglia, who explored some of the most bizarre deaths her state had ever seen. And of course, the first time I ever heard of this story was when I came across the aforementioned post at the Unresolved Mystery subreddit. Now, since Dan Goodgame never actually saw Azat Abul Holsen face-to-face during his trip to Lebanon, I guess technically, we cannot say with absolute 100% certainty that Azat was still alive. But we know he definitely did not die in the garage fire, and given the amount of people, including his own family, who confirmed seeing him in his home village of Tuknai, I think it's pretty much a given that he was living there, though what happened to him afterward is anyone's guess. The problem is that even if Goodgame did find him, there's really not much the American authorities could have done, since Lebanon is a non-extradition treaty country. Azat's fate pretty much would have been in the hands of the local authorities, but given that Tuknai was located in a pretty remote, inaccessible mountain area, I don't think it would have been a top priority for them. One of the reasons Goodgame agreed to leave before he found Azat was because his guide convinced him that Azat could potentially have them killed for sticking their noses into his business, and if that happened, no one would ever find them. So this is an unsolved mystery where the solution to the basic premise is pretty cut and dried. Azat murdered someone and burned his body beyond recognition so he could fake his death and flee the United States. However, there are still a ton of unanswered questions about how this whole thing unfolded. Before we explore this story any further, we need to make some comparisons to the Clarence Roberts case, which I talked about in the intro. There are so many similarities that you'd almost think that Azat used that case as an inspiration, though I have my doubts he would have heard about it at that time. In case you're not familiar with the story, the whole thing was set in motion when a barn on Clarence's property burned down and the badly charred body of a man who was initially assumed to be Clarence was found in the rubble. But even though Azat's fake death managed to fool everyone for a little while, Clarence's pretty much fell apart right away, as there were a number of discrepancies which seemed to indicate that the victim was not him. At the time, Clarence was in serious financial trouble, and since witnesses saw him with an unidentified vagrant at a tavern only 2 days before the fire, it was suspected that Clarence murdered this man and placed him in the burning barn to fake his own death before he disappeared. Like Azat, Clarence had taken out multiple life insurance policies on himself before his death that were worth over $1 million, and his wife Geneva was the beneficiary. It seemed likely that Clarence was planning to stay in hiding until Geneva collected the insurance money and they would use it to start a new life. The problem, of course, was that the insurance companies did not believe Clarence was actually dead and refused to pay out, and after a decade-long legal battle, the court sided in their favor. It became apparent that Geneva was never going to receive any of that money, and shortly thereafter, her house burned to the ground and 2 bodies were found in the rubble. As you probably guessed, they belonged to Geneva and Clarence, and the most likely theory is that Clarence killed Geneva and started the fire before he either committed suicide or died accidentally when he failed to get out in time. Well, obviously, even though Azot was not completely successful with his plan, he did fare much better than Clarence. For several months at least, everyone did believe that the burned body found inside his garage belonged to him, and even though his sister did not get to collect the full $1.3 million in life insurance he had taken out, she did manage to get $500,000 before they caught on that something was wrong. I think it's safe to say that amount of money would stretch Azot pretty far in a remote location like Tuknai, since he appeared to be in the middle of constructing a large villa which was said to resemble a ski chalet. And while the authorities caught on to his scheme, Azot technically did get away with it, and for all we know, he might still be out there right now, living a life of luxury. However, let's start at the very beginning. It sounds like schemes like this weren't unprecedented for Azot, since years earlier, he had been investigated by the Louisville Police Department for allegedly hiring someone to steal his personal items in order to commit insurance fraud. And the fact that Azot married an 18-year-old and almost immediately divorced her after receiving his green card says a lot about his character. But what could have driven him to the point where he decided to commit murder? In Clarence Roberts' case, he was up to his eyeballs in debt and on the verge of losing everything, so his scheme seemed to be born out of pure desperation. It's unclear if Azot was experiencing any serious financial problems at the time, so his scheme might have been motivated by pure greed. He did only have $1.38 in his bank account when he died, but I'm not sure if that's because he was broke or if he cleaned it out to help finance his escape. Azot moved out of his apartment and rented the luxury house a very short time before this all took place, so it makes you wonder, did he realize he couldn't afford to live in such a nice place and decide to come up with this scheme to make a lot of money? Or did he dream up the scheme beforehand and moved into the house simply because he needed access to a garage to make his plan work? Well, Azot had gradually taken out 6 separate life insurance policies over the previous 2 years, so there's a good chance he had been planning this for quite some time. Of course, the fact that he purchased the Chevrolet Vega only a few days before the fire shows that he knew exactly what he was doing. Overall, Azot definitely put together a much more well-rounded plan than Clarence Roberts, and quite frankly, it's really hard to figure out how he pulled it off. It's obvious that Azot was planting the seeds when he went over to see his next-door neighbors, the Kells, and asked to borrow a pair of pliers to repair the fuel line on his car. This struck everyone as a bit odd, because one of Azot's favorite hobbies was working on old cars, so it seems surprising that he wouldn't already have his own set of pliers. But I'm sure Azot did this because he wanted independent eyewitnesses who could verify that he was working on a faulty fuel line, which would add credibility to the idea that a freak accident caused his death. Now, with Clarence Roberts, we know that the body he used to fake his own death was most likely the unidentified vagrant he was seen with 2 days earlier, but to this day, no one has any idea who the burned John Doe found in Azot's garage might be. I have a feeling it's a similar situation, as Azot probably picked up some homeless person, or, considering this was Miami during the early 1980s, an undocumented immigrant. We definitely know the victim did not have very good dental care, so this suggests someone from a poor background. Azot may have lured him inside his garage under the pretense of hiring him to do some work on his car or something before he was murdered. Azot just got very lucky no one happened to see this man at his house that night, but the part which is really hard to grasp is how did Azot manage to escape after the fire started? According to the Kells, they heard what sounded like a whooshing noise from Azot's garage right before they noticed smoke emanating from it, and James Kell immediately ran to the garage while his wife called the fire department, who arrived around 4 or 5 minutes later. It's suspected that the whooshing noise was the gasoline squirting from the punctured fuel line into the portable light, which caused the fire to ignite and burn the John Doe, whom Azot likely pinned underneath the Chevy Vega to prevent him from escaping. Overall, this is a very limited window of time for Azat to have started the fire and fled the garage, and it sounds like no one else recalled seeing anyone running or driving away from the scene that night, right after the fire started. I mean, Clarence Roberts lived on a rural property, so you can understand why no one saw him escaping, but Azat lived in a suburban neighborhood where it would have been much harder to get away undetected. Azat did own another car besides the Chevy Vega, but it was left behind and given to his sister after he was declared dead, so I have no idea what he used for transportation to get out of the area. I guess it's possible that Azat could have hidden somewhere in the house for several hours and then made his escape once the police and fire department left the scene, but that's still insanely risky, especially when you consider that the flames had started spreading and engulfing the house before they were put out. And then there's Azat's best friend, Bassam Wakil. I know that it's never been conclusively proven that Bassam had any knowledge or involvement in Azat's scheme, but I really have a hard time believing that he did not know what was going to happen. It's quite a convenient coincidence that the fire just happened to start during the time period when Bassam left the house to get a pizza, and I'm skeptical that Azat could have managed to keep the unidentified John Doe concealed during the time period Bassam was there, helping him work on the car. Remember, the victim's official cause of death was smoke inhalation, and he had so much carbon monoxide in his system that he was definitely still alive when he was burned. This is just an incredibly sadistic way to kill someone, but there's a good chance Azat knew his plan wouldn't work if the medical examiner could determine that the victim was already dead before the fire started. The point being, unless Azat was keeping this guy tied up in his basement or something, how would Bassam not have seen him? If Bassam wasn't involved, then Azat was leaving an awful lot to chance, since his plan relied on Bassam leaving to go get some dinner, and Azat somehow having enough time to bring the John Doe into the garage, trap him beneath the car, start the fire, and flee the scene before Bassam got back. I think Azat wanted someone else there to function as a witness and confirm that he was inside the garage working on the fuel line underneath the Vega shortly before the fire started. Bassam would then add credibility to the situation by giving off a shocked, melodramatic reaction when he returned and discovered that the garage was on fire. Bassam's complicity is supported by the fact that he decided to dump the victim's ashes into the ocean once he was informed that they did not belong to Azat. Why not give them back to the police as evidence in case this man has a family out there somewhere who might want his remains back? All that being said, I'm not sure if Bassam was paid a cut of the insurance money for his role in this scheme, so if he was involved, I'm not sure what motive he would have to be complicit in a murder while his friend went off to live the good life in another country. And then there's the possible complicity of Azat's sister, Gada Abulhulsen, who was the beneficiary of her brother's life insurance money. Yes, when Azat's scheme was exposed, she acted all shocked and disgusted and exclaimed that she wanted no part of her brother's dirty money, but I honestly don't see how this plan could have worked if she wasn't in on it from the beginning. If Gada was completely left in the dark, then Azat would have been taking a huge risk about being able to get his hands on that money. Considering that Azat and Gada had shared an apartment together for 18 months, I could definitely see them being close enough for him to entrust her with something like this. Let's just assume for a second that Gada was completely innocent. At the time Azat's death took place, Gada was studying nursing in Tampa, but when she learned about what happened to her brother, she decided to give all that up and return back home to Lebanon in order to mourn him. She then returned to the United States months later to collect the first $500,000 insurance payment before going back to Lebanon and permanently settling in her home village of Tuknai. Well, what if Gada had decided that she wanted to continue study nursing in the US and decided to remain there instead of returning to Lebanon? What if she decided to spend all the insurance money on herself, which would have been within her rights since she was the beneficiary? Once Gada found out Azat was still alive and had committed murder and insurance fraud, how could he even be certain that she would give the money to him rather than just going to the authorities? There are too many complications that I have to thank Gata was in on this all along, and there's a good chance she played a role in helping Azat escape to Lebanon undetected. It's also quite strange that when investigators wanted a picture of Azat to compare his teeth against the jawbones of the burned body, Gata claimed that most of his photo identification, including his passport, green card, and driver's license, were in Lebanon. Well, that would make sense if the investigators had given those items to Gata following his death, but they did not find them among his possessions, so how would they have wound up in Lebanon? Gata always maintained that she did not find out Azat was still alive until December of 1982, after she already traveled to Florida to collect the insurance money. But a few residents from Tuknai would claim they saw Azat and Gata return there only 1 or 2 days apart in late May or early June. This is a village of only around 2,500 residents where everyone knows each other's business, so I just don't see how Gata would be completely unaware of her brother's presence there for about 5 or 6 months. There's also the weird timing of Gata attempting to have her brother's body flown back home for burial, only for things to be held up after Operation Peace for Galilee broke out, causing all the airports to be closed. You'd think that Gata would be willing to wait things out until the conflict was resolved, because I'm sure the rest of Azat's family, including his mother and 5 other sisters, would have appreciated the chance to say goodbye to him. But no, Gata just decided to give Bassam the okay to cremate her brother. That would be bizarre enough on its own, but it's especially troubling when you consider that every single resident of Tuknai practices the Druze religious faith, which forbids the practice of cremation. There really only seems to be one reason why Gata would allow this. She knew the body did not belong to Azat, and probably didn't want it hanging around in Florida in case the authorities became suspicious. I'm willing to bet that if this body had been transported to Lebanon, no one would have ever seen it again. Ultimately, I'm not sure if Gata made much of a profit from this scheme, as she was living with her mother when Dan Goodgame tracked her down and had pretty much become an outcast in the village because of the suspicions about her complicity with Azat. It's possible that because they only wound up collecting $500,000 of the insurance money rather than the expected $1.3 million, Gata's cut did not turn out to be as large as she expected. But on the other hand, it sounds like Azat was taking great advantage of his newfound wealth by constructing a large villa and purchasing multiple vehicles in an area which was not exactly known for its opulent wealth. Under normal circumstances, it would be extremely brazen for a guy who made all this money through murder and fraud to just be flaunting himself like this, but since it was a remote, hard-to-reach location in the mountains of Lebanon, I'm sure Azat thought he was untouchable. When Goodgame spoke to Gata, she said Azat had taken all of his clothing and money and left because he was planning to go live in Europe for a few years, but others believed he was still hiding out in the area somewhere. I think it's very unlikely that Azat fled the country, because he had already invested so much money into building his villa, and while Lebanon did not have an extradition treaty with the US, virtually all of the countries in Europe did, so Azat was much safer remaining there. Since Azat would have known he was not receiving the rest of his insurance money, and the authorities were on to him, it would not have been wise for him to travel to Europe only 1 year removed from having faked his own death. I'm sure someone tipped Azat off that an American journalist was trying to make his way to the village, which prompted him to go into temporary hiding, but what happened to him after Goodgame left is anybody's guess. I know that one villager told Goodgame that everyone greatly approved of what Azat did, and they would take him to the American embassy to face punishment, but even if they did, American officials would be pretty powerless to do anything because of the lack of extradition treaty. If Azat returned to Tuknai, he would not have been very difficult to find, given that he had the largest residence there. If there really was that much resentment towards Azat, and it was apparent he would not face justice for his crimes, you have to wonder if someone might have been compelled to inflict a little vigilante justice on him. If Azat was murdered, then there's a very good chance his body would never be found, And since I'm sure news does not travel fast from such a remote region, who knows if the outside world would even find out about it. But on the other hand, Tuknai sounds like such an insular bubble that for all we know, Azok could still be living in that same luxury villa to this day. Once it became apparent that Azok could not be extradited back to the US, both the authorities and the media stopped paying attention to him, so anything's possible. If you go to the aforementioned post at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, you'll find a comment there from the original poster, Wes Kendall Jenner, who claims they found an old profile page on a dating website from the mid to late 2000s, which belonged to someone named Azot Abulholsen, who had the exact same birth date. Of course, there's no way of knowing if this was the exact same guy, especially when you consider that everyone who lived in Tuknai had Abulholsen as a surname. But if he is, then that means Azot was alive for at least 20 to 25 years following his escape from the US. If he is still alive today, he would currently be 67 years old. I have no idea about the current whereabouts of Gada Abulholsen, but from online searches, it looks like Bassam Wakil is still alive and living in Florida. As for the unidentified John Doe, he does have his own profile page on Namus, though it doesn't look like he's listed on the Doe Network. If the victim was a homeless person or an undocumented immigrant, he may not have anybody out there who's looking for him. While he was cremated and his ashes scattered into the ocean, it's possible that his jawbones are still in storage after all these years, and extracting DNA from them might be the only chance of ever making an identification. Barring some miracle, such as Azot deciding to set foot on US soil again, I think there's very little chance that this mystery will ever be solved. But if by chance you happen to have any information on the whereabouts of Azot Abulholsen, or if you think you might know the identity of the John Doe, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we covered a story which was featured on the very first episode of Unsolved Mysteries, involving a woman named Pat Mielbach and her attempts to find out if she was the biological daughter of automobile manufacturing pioneer John Francis Dodge. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Brittany H., Allison, Annie G., Desiree, Terry Lynn F., and Todd W. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for a new podcast which has just been launched by one of The Trail Went Cold's regular listeners. It's called Amazing Maine.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Amazing Maine podcast. I'm Scott, your host, and in this podcast, I'm going to talk about everything that makes the northeasternmost state in the USA a special place. We're going to talk about interesting history, great places, distinctive food, fascinating businesses, and a lot of strange cultural things that make Maine a very unique place. I'll be putting up episodes every other week, and I'm really looking forward to sharing my adopted home state with all of you. So if you live in Maine, you've vacationed here, or just curious about the only monosyllabically named state in the Union, then this podcast is for you. Or maybe you just want to hear an out-of-work, middle-aged guy struggle with the technical concepts of podcasting. In that case, this is definitely the podcast for you. So please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite platform. Our first episode is already available. The podcast is on Podbean, iTunes, and Google Play Music. Also, please connect with us on social media. Search Facebook for Amazing Maine Podcast and like our page. Look us up on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is @AmazingMainePod. And if you would like to contact me directly, please send me an email to AmazingMainePodcast@gmail.com. I'm looking for ideas, suggestions, and any kind of feedback you may have. Thank you for listening.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, and of course, the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, where you can find a very interesting post about this case. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.